Welcome to the Off Track Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Matt Eshe. Thank you for joining us and taking time out of your week to listen to the table talk, debate, enlighten, make fun of each other, whatever the case might be. Your listenership is something that everyone at the table always respects and honors, and hopefully every week we do you justice and we do you some good. So this week, the focused and driven Chris Chavez pulls a chair to the table. Chris is the lead writer of the sport of track and field for Sports Illustrated, the founder of the SidiousMag.com and Sidious Mag podcast, a top five podcast, running podcast in the world right now. So sit back, pop a top at the table with Darren, Tom, Scott, Nelson, and Herb as we talk to Chris about how he started writing about track and field at Marquette University while he's a freshman, the job offers he had and turned down out of college, the one question he did or did not ask Usain Bolt, and I can't remember, and what is his goal for minority sports writers in the very near future. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the table, Chris Chavez.
Chris, where are you at now?
I'm in New York City. Yeah. So I've been here since graduating. So I'm going on 6 years. Sports Illustrated's offices are downtown right by World Trade Center. And so I live out in Queens. I just commute, in normal times I'd commute on the subway and then, I do most of my running in the city and all that. But it's been good. I was born and raised here in New York. So I came back.
Cool.
So are you from Brooklyn or Queens?
I'm from Queens. I grew up in Queens, went to high school in Manhattan, and then tried the Midwest for college and then came back east.
So why Marquette though?
Marquette was I went to a Jesuit high school. I was in a summer program for like advancing sort of like my studies when I was in seventh and eighth grade. And so I was just very in tune with like just the Jesuit education and, it came down for me to Marquette and, Missouri, which was interesting because one would have just been like a huge state school, but like a great journalism program. And the scholarship offer I got from Marquette was good. And then like, once I visited the campus, I saw just sort of like how it was more like my high school where not as big, but like the sense of community was just so much better, I felt like. And so, I felt more comfortable doing that. So I went there and then, you know, every winter it would get so cold out in Milwaukee. I would just open up the transfer applications to like, you know, Miami and all these other schools that I dreamed of probably getting out to some warmer weather, but never pulled the trigger. And I, you know, manned up and got through 4 years and, you know, it made me tough coming back to New York after that. Like winters, I'd be in shorts, like in 35 degree weather. But now that, you know, 5-6 years have passed, like I've definitely softened back up and I want no part to do with the Midwest winter again.
There's something that is just brutal about the Midwest winter.
Yeah.
How did you get
Chris, I was going to say, tell them about, and this was on YouTube, I think, but you did like a, not like a selection show, but you did like a recruiting thing where you had in front of you and it got a lot of hits on, I think, YouTube. It was really hilarious. It was super funny.
It was really, I took it down because, you know, a couple of people started finding it when I was in college and I was like, this is a little embarrassing, but I tried to mimic LeBron James's decision. Hyped up my college decision for weeks in advance. And some of my friends thought I was going to end up going to Syracuse or even like UConn. And Marquette came out of nowhere for these, some of these friends. And to most people, I would say at my high school, but, it was like the early ages of Twitter and that kind of stuff where, it was just week after week of hyping up sort of this decision. And then when I filmed it in my hotel at the, it might've been at the Pfister and, I had the same exact shirt that LeBron had in his video. And so what I did was I intercut my answers to Jim Gray's questions from that interview. And then ultimately he asked me like, what's my decision? And then I said, like, I'm going to be taking my talents to Milwaukee and joining the Marquette Golden Eagles. And then from there, like I posted the video for my college decision and like got a bunch of texts from friends and stuff like that. They didn't expect it, but it was fun. And then even like in college, I remember my first journalism class, they made us like simulate what it would be like being like a reporter. We tried to cover like simulate different events in history. So one was like, you know, Princess Diana's you know, car crash. Like, if you were a reporter, how would you have covered that? And then, like, for the final, we walk in and this video is playing on the screen. And so the whole class has to write, how would you have covered Chris's college decision? And so after that is when I took the video down, or just hit it on private on YouTube, because I was like, okay, I didn't mean for this to get this much attention.
It was hilarious. I thought it was great, man. I got a kick out of it.
You're ahead of your time. That's all those kids are doing that now, you know?
Oh, and, yeah. And nowadays, that like, kids are that, announcing yeah, decisions on TikTok and all this weird stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really cool.
So you that D-Wade connection now, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I gather this new thing. We're trying something out. I gather this from talking to Mike a little bit, but you didn't run at Marquette, correct?
No, that's what a lot of people sort of assume, is that I ran at Marquette, that I was a distance runner in high school. I wasn't. I was a very average sprinter at Xavier High School in Manhattan, all boys school. The only reason I joined the track team was because, you know, a bunch of my buddies who were in the lockers around me were on the team, and they were having a blast. And so they all just kind of suggested one day, like, why don't you come out to practice and just see if you like it. And it was cool to just hang out with everyone else after school. The only thing I was doing before that was writing for the school newspaper. So this is something totally different. I got into writing for the school newspaper because I didn't make the freshman baseball team. Like, I wanted to play for the New York Yankees, and now that I couldn't, I got cut. I was just like, well, I gotta stay close to sports somehow. And so the next closest thing is probably to report on sports. And then from there, I started to get back into sports with track as a sophomore, but I was not good whatsoever. Like, I remember it took me multiple tries to break 30 seconds for the 200, and like the 400 felt like forever for me. My first ever race, I think, might have been like a 75 second 400, and then that just stood there for a while. I just couldn't. It felt hard. And so for me, track in high school was just, you know, extra time with friends. And so when I graduated high school, I just didn't like, my last race was my best race. It was a 25 1 200, and so I was like getting better. But then it just like, there's no more opportunities for me to sprint anymore, because from there,
25-1 guy, yeah,
no. Yeah, like a 25-1 guy is not going to get a lane at any sort of, like, you know, invitational meet or anything like that. So I got to Marquette, and I think I saw my buddy really early on, who also went to my high school and was a freshman with me. He started putting on the freshman 15 right away, and I was just like, this is not going to be me. Like, I need to get active. And so I was just like, you know, people run 5Ks and like they do those for charity, I guess. So maybe I'll just start doing that, and I'll just run 5Ks every now and then. And so I just started running 2 miles a day, 3 miles a day, really slow. Like, if I go back and try to even think of like the paces I was running, I'm guessing it would have been anywhere from 8:30 to 9 minute pace. And so nowadays, like, I have to really force myself to go that slow, but that was just where I was at with running. And one day I watched the New York City Marathon on TV as a freshman, and I was like, okay, I want to do that someday, because that looks really cool to me. So I just, the next day, the New York City Marathon lottery opened up right after the race. And so I was like, all right, sign up. Thankfully didn't get in, because, you know, making that jump from 200 meters to 26.2 would have been just reckless and ridiculous. So eventually I just started running half marathons. And I remember my first ever half marathon was in Milwaukee. It was like the Milwaukee Brewers, like half marathon. It finishes really close. I think you do a lap around the outer part of the stadium, and then you finish right in the parking lot. And my goal for that was to break 2 hours. And I did it. I ran like 1:57, and I was so happy. And so half marathon started to be my thing. And so I maybe did like 5 of them. And this entire time sort of, it also sort of aligns with the point of me starting to follow the sport, because there was a random Friday night. I just decided to stay in. I was like, I'm not going to go out with my friends, even as a freshman, I think this was, or sophomore. And so I just stayed in, and I checked Twitter, and one of my friends retweeted a FloTrek live stream of like the Occidental meet that was happening in May. And so I clicked into it, and I was like, oh, what is this? And so all of a sudden I'm watching these guys running a 5K, and I'm someone who had just run a 5K maybe a couple weeks ago, but I ran like 20 minutes. I see Dathan Ritzenhine run 13 minutes, and he's delivering this interview afterwards where he's like super hyped up. And I'm like, that guy's going to be great at the Olympics. Like, and the Olympics are only a couple miles away, a couple months away. So I'm thinking, this guy's really excited. And he was like, I think this is after he had come out of like a long string of injuries, and it was like the first good race that he put together. And this excitement was just contagious to me, where I all of a sudden wanted to know more about the sport. And so I went back and started watching old race videos and reading old Sports Illustrated articles. And I think I even like asked the school newspaper to cover the Marquette track team, because like, I thought this was really cool. And so no one really was covering the Marquette track team. Like you think of the basketball team, you think, and like they would send, you know, the freshman riders out to cover tennis and stuff, but no one really, it's a huge team, but they really never assigned anyone to go cover them, aside from maybe writing up a short little 100 word blurb on like what happened throughout the weekend that you could get off like the Athletics website. So I carved it out as like a beat, and I was just like, I started writing stories on the athletes. It would be like maybe a profile a week, and then like a recap later on how they did. And Coach Mike Nelson and I just started getting in touch kind of constantly, just, you know, feeding me, here's an interesting story that maybe you might be interested in. And then I'd kind of explore it and that kind of stuff. So it was good to bring attention to like the Marquette track team. And I noticed that it's sort of like, this was the entire time as I'm learning the sport, I'm realizing that there's just, track is one of these sports that doesn't get as much attention unless it's like the Olympic year, mm-hmm. or maybe the year before the Olympics. And so, but there's this window of opportunity where there's 3 years or so where no one is telling these cool stories. And it's, you know, especially gets lost sort of like on the college level, because they're, you know, they're not the A-list student athletes. And so I was just like, all right, I got my reps in sort of covering Marquette. And then all of a sudden that summer rolls up and I decide to shoot a message to Ryan Fenton at FlowTrack to see if he would get me a credential to cover the Adidas Grand Prix in New York City. And that kind of like really kicked off sort of my kind of entry into covering the sport at the highest level. So so it kind of goes hand in hand. Like I got into distance running in college very early on. And then at the same time I found the sport and then started like to really get into it and like reading and watching it.
So Mike and Tom, since you guys were there when he was starting to do this kind of stuff, how were the articles?
Tom wasn't actually there at the time, because Tom had graduated.
Oh, okay.
But Chris did a fantastic job. He did an absolutely fantastic job, because as a lot of you know on this show, you know, when they assign you a new sports information person or someone that's covering your team, oftentimes they walk in and the first thing they say is, "I don't know anything about track, but I'm here to help you out and to write about your team." And you're like, "Oh, great. Like, I'm going to have to explain how the cross country meet is scored. And I'm going to have to explain how this is done and that is done." Whereas with Chris, you were already past all that, right? And you could have these in-depth conversations with him about the nuances of what's going on with the team and the meets and the planning, the scheduling and things like that. And, you know, he could take that story and run with it. So it was really nice to have someone who just had already they knew about track and field and had that knowledge, but more importantly, passion for it.
Well, I'm going to piggyback on what Mike said there. I was not there at the time, but I do remember, I think I reached out to Chris and said, "Hey, thank you for covering Marquette track and field." I was early in my coaching career, and just like what Mike was saying, you know, you get assigned a new SID, and I vividly remember sending some of the articles that Chris had written for the Marquette track and field team to our new SID and saying, "Hey, take a look at this. This is like the gold standard. This is what we need to do."
That's and right. At this time, you know, Chris was like 19 years old, you know, 18 years old. So, you know, to be that young in the sport and then, you know, slowly, you know, getting bigger and stronger in terms of, you know, your journalistic abilities and everything. And now having, what is it, the number one running podcast in the country.
I have no idea if like the stats would put it at number one, but like it's just fun for me.
Isn't it, Matt? I think it's the number one.
No, most weeks it's in the top five. I'll tell you that one. I'll tell you that much for sure. Like Molly Sandell's podcast normally holds that number one spot for some reason. I don't know what the name of it is. I'm sorry, Molly. Another Wisconsinite right there. But I know that one is always up there. But Chris, I know the Serious Mag is always up on that kind of thing.
Oh, I've stopped kind of like taking a close look. I get two in my head, and then I'm also like super competitive sometimes. So I'm just, you know, popping and churning as many episodes as I can from time to time. I mean, I think down the road, like podcasting has just been the medium that I've really like grown to love within the last like 3 years. Writing for sure, like will always be first for me, but it's always also like much easier to have a conversation with someone for an hour or 2 hours and not have to worry about transcribing everything and then just like putting it up, and 2 hours later it's there for everyone to enjoy. So in that sort of way, like that's been a lot of fun for me to have sort of like that creative outlet to do that.
So I got to ask, what did FloTrack give you a chance to do? Because you talked about, yes, you got the media credential to cover the Adidas Grand Prix meet, you know, and then go from there. Because FloTrack, let's give Ryan and those guys doing an incredible job taking legitimately nothing and turning it into something, just like you did at Marquette. There was nothing there and turned it into a very attractive product. Tom doesn't give out many compliments. So that's a pretty good thing to hear Tom give out a compliment right there. So where does that parlay to?
Yeah, so at that point, FloTrack was very video heavy. And it had, I think I remember taking over the Twitter account that first day, and it was 20,000, 28,000 like followers. And if you look at it now, it's 100,000 plus or whatever. And so when I shot that message, it was mainly because I knew that Usain Bolt had run a world record at that meet. And if there was the off chance that he was going to be running at that meet, it'd be really cool to, you know, see him and be up close, like from the media perspective. So that's why I kind of shot that random email maybe a couple weeks later after watching Oxy. And I asked him if I could get a credential, and he got me squared away right away. So my assignment that day was just to do live tweeting for the meet, which was fairly easy. But then at some point there was a lot of athletes coming through. I think the races just with a Diamond League schedule were just jam-packed one after the other, where if you have two guys doing interviews, you're not going to get everyone that you want for them, especially at this point. It was just the point and shoot video camera interviews that they would shoot up right after a race. And so I remember getting handed a camera and being like, oh, why don't you just go and get a couple interviews? And the first person I ever like stood in front of with my camera, and I don't even remember if I had asked a question, but I would, I guess, categorize him as my first interview would have been, was Oscar Pistorius, which is really funny to think about now, because there's no chance that I'll get a chance to talk to him again because he's in jail in South Africa. But I kind of remember there might've been one or two other interviews. What stood out to them, I think, was just sort of maybe the work ethic that I showed that day, not being fazed by these athletes. And I think that's part of the part of the reason for that was because I was still so new to the sport, where I wasn't much of a fan. Like I appreciated the performances and the fast times, but I just didn't know, you know, who some of these medal contenders and past world champions were who were standing right in front of me. So there wasn't that fanboy, you know, starstruck component to me. I was just there to do my job. And I remember leaving that meet and telling Mark Floriani, who founded FloTrack, that if you guys ever need me, you know, I'm available. I'm going to go back to school. So if there's any event in the Midwest, just, you know, give me a call. Also, like, I'd be more than happy to help bolster sort of like the writing on your site. Like, I noticed that there isn't too much on there. I'm more than happy to just, you know, write articles. And, you know, I was never asking for money at this point. I was just looking for sort of like the experience in the end. And so I did get like a call, like a really nice email afterwards. And then they brought up the Wisconsin cross country meet, that would have been a couple weeks, later on in the fall. And this is when FloTrack was experimenting with live streaming meets, but this one wasn't live. It was one where they filmed from the front car. And then later on, we went back to the hotel and then just like dubbed over the commentary. And then it would be up by the next morning for people to enjoy and rewatch. Mm-hmm. My assignment sort of for that was to help these guys like come up with information to talk about all the runners. Now, Ryan and Alex very clearly knew the sport and that kind of stuff, but I just didn't know like who some of these big people were, especially now we're dealing college athletes, like less of the higher profile. So I remember going on practically every single team's website and like coming up with like a fact sheet for all these different athletes who some of these people maybe never even finished in the top 50 or even top 100 of that race. I might've been going like alphabetical. And it was just, pages and pages of these notes that I had like compiled. And I didn't even know how handy it was, but for them, they just saw that like I was kind of good at finding sort of this information and then putting it together and just being helpful. So after that, it was a hit. They just kind of liked having me around for that meet. I did a couple more interviews there. And they asked me, would you be down to do meets out in California or Minnesota and, you know, Stanford and Florida. And I was like, yeah, those are going to be really tough for me to get to because one, I don't have my license because I'm a New Yorker and you don't get that until you really need it. And two, it's like, that would be a really long bus ride from Milwaukee. Yep. And they're like, no, don't worry about it. Like, we'll take care of your flight and hotel. And I was like, well, if you're taking me out of Wisconsin in the middle of the winter, yes.
A lot of things I'll do to get out of Wisconsin in the middle of the winter.
So I practically sacrificed every single college weekend from then on to go out to the Florida Relays, the Stanford Invitational, Peyton Jordan, and all these different meets. And again, was just doing a bunch of interviews, writing previews for those meets throughout the week. And just getting kind of like that firsthand boots on the ground experience. And it was super valuable for me. at this point, kind of, this is during my sophomore year, and I got accepted to the Sports Journalism Institute, which is a summer program where they take like 13 students from across the country to do, they're typically minority students or women, just to kind of try and, you know, give them the tools to find jobs and internships at newspapers and media outlets across the country to kind of help up those numbers. And so I was one of the 13 chosen, and I was a finalist for an internship at ESPN, but they ended up giving it to a girl who was a year older. And so all of a sudden I'm in the program, but I still haven't gotten placed to an internship. And so they were just like, okay, well, most people were assigned to places close to home. And for me, home is New York. And yep. I would have been like, okay, I guess I'll end up at like the Daily News or like MLB.com or something like that. And they just hit me with out of nowhere. They're like, well, we're going to send you to the Salt Lake Tribune. And I'm like, oh, like that's nowhere.
Far away.
Yeah. And also I'm kind of scratching my head. I was like, what sports are even going on in the summertime in Salt Lake City? And so, still didn't have my license, and I was just kind of like panicking at this point where I'm like, what am I going to do in Utah for the summer? But I came around to it, and I was like ready to, I guess this is just the traditional journalism path that people go through. Like they go to a small newspaper one summer, a medium-sized newspaper next summer, and then maybe they, you know, get that big internship the following year. And then it's just kind of like how people do the journalism practice, I felt like. And so every summer, FloTrack had an intern that got to go to Europe. And one day, Ryan Fenton calls me. He's like, what are you doing this summer? And I was like, I'm going to Salt Lake City for this program. And he's like, well, how would you feel about going to Europe and bouncing around from country to country and doing, you know, diamond leagues and going out to cover that? And I was like, that sounds much better than Salt Lake City. And
rough life right there. Rough life. Yeah.
Yeah. I was faced with this decision, which was really hard to make at the time. Cause I would have been burning this bridge with the Sports Journalism Institute, which is historically the alums from that thing have gone on to go and do some great things in sports journalism. And it was foregoing that traditional path that people take. So I was just like, all right, I got on a call with them and I explained to them my decision. I was like, I'm going to do this with FloTrack. And like, I know that this really sucks. And like, I know there's so few students in this program, mm-hmm. but I'm going to take a risk. And I did it. I went out there, I bounced around from country to country. It was my first time out in Europe. I'm 19 years old. And that summer was super valuable in the long run. Like to this day, like I'm super appreciative of Ryan entrusting me with that, because it got me, you know, some time with athletes and coaches and especially agents to get to know me. And that's super valuable to me to this day. And that summer was just awesome. I got to see some world-class races, and it was practically an all expenses paid trip to Europe. And it was amazing.
So safe to say you did end up getting that driver's license.
I got my driver's license as a senior at Marquette, and I remember taking driver's ed classes to the point where people would see me get into the car right in front of my apartment, and they're like, "Chris, are you taking driver's?" I'm like, yeah. Like, I'm 21. I think it's about time I get this thing.
Like, no, actually, I'm the one teaching it. It was going to be a side gig for me, no matter what I was doing. So I'm going to come back to a couple other things here with a couple questions, but one thing I want to go, I think it works well. Did you, is that the inspiration for the Citius Mag? Because you guys have done a great job, not only with the podcast, with the website itself and with the writing that you guys do and the coverage that you do, the interviews have been great. But like, is that the inspiration for that? Is that where this whole thing started?
So I think it's still a couple years removed, because that was 2012, and then Citius Mag didn't start until 2017. So in that in-between period, yep. You know, I got pretty embedded with FloTrack, and it was great. Like, I started getting paid, and that, like, it was just kind of the continual grind. It was just long nights of uploading videos and staying in hotels with Ryan and Alex till the really late hours, really early hours of the morning. And it was quite the grind. And so I did that until 2014, but the summer of 2014, I made amends with the Sports Journalism Institute, and they took me back.
Wow.
'Cause I think someone at ESPN had remembered that I was a finalist the previous year. And so it kind of just was in their head as to, like, all right, well, you know, Chris was our finalist, so where is he? Like, why isn't he in the class? And I just didn't bother to apply, because I thought that bridge was gone and that I just left this bad taste in their mouth, having turned them down the previous year. So they were asking about me, and the Sports Journalism Institute reached out to me, and they're like, why didn't you apply? And I was like, because I thought you guys hated me. And so then they gave me 24 hours to submit an application, and I did that. And very soon after, an internship at ESPN, you know, popped up. And I think it was because they recognized that what I was doing at FloTrack was more than I probably would have done in Salt Lake City. And for a whole summer, FloTrack depended on me for content. So many of the American athletes just go out to Europe and race out there. There isn't as much going on here. So, you know, some of these written previews for meets in Houston and Paris and that kind of stuff were coming from me. The pre-race videos are coming from me. The post-race videos are coming from me. Some of these workout Wednesdays were me. Like, that's a lot. And I'm 19 years old at the time. So I think someone at ESPN recognized that, hey, I mean, like, that was legit. And so I got to spend 10 weeks in Bristol, Connecticut, working at the ESPN headquarters. My boss there is a runner, and like, he's a huge fan of running to this day. So that was also great, because he kind of gave me a sandbox to play in. He was like, if you want to write about running for ESPN.com, go for it, because, you know, there aren't too many people doing it. And so if you have an interesting story, pitch it to one of the editors and just do it. And that kind of carried over into when I went back to school. The internship expired, and I went back, and I'm writing, covering the marathons for ESPN that fall and into the following spring. And so that was super valuable to me as well, because it gave me sort of that mainstream sort of name on my resume that everyone recognized. It's ESPN. And from there, at some point in February, I started talks with Sports Illustrated. A friend of mine worked there and kind of made a connection. And so it came down to ESPN or Sports Illustrated for me upon graduation. And like, I recognize that 21-year-olds coming out of college don't usually have that decision. Yeah. So I'm very, very lucky in that sense. And, you know, part of me really cherished how Sports Illustrated covers the Olympics historically. And it's in New York City as opposed to, you know, Bristol, Connecticut, and I'm going to come back home. So I decided to take the job at Sports Illustrated. And for me, that whole first year was just kind of doing, it was a fellowship that turned into a full-time job. So for that first year, I'm just kind of doing my duties as a fellow my first year, covering breaking news. But at the same time, once again, it felt like it was a playground for me to cover running. Yes, Tim Layden's like the A-lister writer for the site, but he's not focused on track, you know, 90% of the year. It's more of like that 10% of the year. And it's the World Championships, US Championships, Olympics. So I felt like I was the one to do, I took it upon myself to just bring more coverage to SI.com and also use this time. It's a year before the next Olympics. I could make that Olympic team sort of for SI. And that was a goal and a dream of mine for years, sort of like since 2012. Like I started getting my feet wet with Sports Illustrated. I watched the 2012 Olympics. I knew what was going on now. And so I kind of made it a mental goal. I want to cover an Olympics in 2016, and I never thought it would be with Sports Illustrated, but it was the case. And it really was a dream come true for me. Teared up during the opening ceremonies, went and saw as many events as I could, like outside of just track. I think my motto for those 3.5 weeks was just go see things that you had never seen before. Write some stories. I wrote my first ever story out of the Olympics was a table tennis story. And that was awesome.
Was that the best one you got to see? Was it table tennis? What was it?
Table tennis was the first story. And it was just because the kid was born. It was a US Olympian born in 2000. And I wanted to see it for myself. I was like, this is going to make me feel old. Like this kid doesn't know what a VCR is. And so I went to table tennis. I went to a couple, some nights of swimming. I covered gymnastics, which was, that was a random assignment that was thrown on me. They were like, Chris, would you be okay? Because track hadn't started at this point. They're like, would you be okay covering gymnastics for the next 2 days? And I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, like I'm a rookie. Like I have to say yes to everything. And kind of like, I'm sitting in the gymnastics arena. Thankfully, the United States is really good and you know that they're going to win. So you can kind of start to frame your story around the fact that they win. But the whole time I'm sitting there just kind of with my ears perked up and listening to people call out different things. Like she just did this move. And she just did this move. And I'm like, all right, like I know what moves this girl's doing. I'm adding this to my story. And then like got away with it for 2 days. So that was fun. But yeah, yeah, I got away with it. And then for track, it was 2.5 weeks or 2 weeks. And that was, yeah, you know, incredible. I got to work alongside Tim Layden. So he handled the main story for SI. And then I was just kind of like the instant sort of recap that came out. Like as soon as the race ended, like I was up on SI.com right away. And like for me, this is something like, I like to tell people like I'm getting ready for the games like first I tell mainly girls I'm going to the Olympics and then I say I'm getting ready for the games. And what that means is I'm actually like just nerding out and just pre-writing a ton of stuff and getting together some stats that are like, okay, if Usain Bolt wins, here are some stats that, you know, he's going to break and like our records he's going to break and all this kind of stuff, or here's some like notable times. And so I do that weeks in advance. That's me getting ready for the games. And so, yeah, I'm ready. Like, and so I usually take the time from like April to June to do that. And then eventually I even do it for the trials and all that. So, yeah, I think it's coming up on time for me to get ready for the games again. And this time around, like Tim Layden has moved on to NBC Sports. If the Olympics do happen, which knock on wood, I'm hoping, that's the case. Yeah. Then I guess it might fall on me to be the A guy this time around, which would be amazing. But so kind of that's the SparkNotes version of those years in between the start of Sidious. What Sidious came out of was just sort of that period coming back from the Olympics. This was the highest of high for me. And now I have to wait 4 more years to experience it again. It was hard because I spent 2012 to 2016 I guess, like chasing getting to a position to go to the Olympics. And so writer's block all of a sudden hit me. And like, it's a real thing. You sometimes hear about it, but it was real. Like, I just didn't know what I was going to do now, because like I kind of said at the very beginning, you realize that people sometimes only care about track in the year before and the year of the Olympics. So now I have 2 years before I even get to that point. Sports Illustrated's audience and readers are typically, you know, big NFL people, big NBA people. So we're busy with that stuff. And I don't want to have to bug an editor of mine who handles some of that stuff with like, hey, here's a 500 word story on the Peyton Jordan Invitational. And here's something cool that someone did, you know, in the Tokyo Marathon or something like that. And so I kind of recognize that, like, I don't want to be a nuisance for 2 years, because if you backtrack, I put in that time with Flow Track where like, yep, I am catering to the track nerds, but now I don't have to. But for me, I'm super passionate about covering the sport where I want to. I just kind of can't, like, right now. So my hands are tied behind my back, and I'm thinking of like, how can I get around this? And so yeah, I took it upon myself to just kind of come up with the idea for Sidious Mag, which was, we know letsrun.com is where you're going to get your headlines and the links to all these results and news stories. Flow Track, you get videos, you watch live, you know, live footage. Same with Runner Space. But I felt like there was an area that was missing where it was, and I'm a huge fan of Bill Simmons, where it was like the commentary, the humor, the relatability, sometimes pop culture. And I was like, well, why can't we have that in running? And so I teamed up with a bunch of friends of mine that I'd met over the years in covering the sport. And we just decided to give this a go in February 2017. And we came out of the gates pretty hot, like lots of relatable stories. Not necessarily even stories. It's just like articles about things that people experience on the run. And like, people were attached to it. I started the podcast pretty early on, and for me, again, ripping a page out of Simmons's playbook, this is just a laid back conversation every week with an athlete or a coach, or anyone really interesting in the sport. And it kind of just evolved from there, where for me, I've had it so much fun doing the podcast. And then I made the executive decision maybe like about 2 years ago to lean heavily into podcast. And so now we're up to like 7 or 8 different shows, and like, they're all a little bit interesting and different in their own sort of ways, where Sidious Mag podcast is me. It's the flagship show and doing interviews. Runners of New York City is a show where we interview people who are everyday people in New York City, but also run and are either like crew leaders or they balance full-time jobs. Dana Giordano has a podcast where she interviews women who are entrepreneurs, athletes, coaches within the sport. Scott Fottwell has a podcast where he just talks about movies with other runners or coaches. So it's a fun sort of avenue of covering the sport, where the agreement I had with Sports Illustrated, eventually when they do realize that, what are you doing like outside of your Sports Illustrated work? And the agreement in place is sort of anything that I originally report, or feature stories and that kind of stuff. Those original stories that I kind of did for at the Marquette Tribune, like, those kind of stories would go to Sports Illustrated. Anytime you're being too much of a geek and just catering to the track nerds and you're trying to be funny and that kind of stuff, and it's, then you just do it for Sidious. And that's kind of like the balance I've had, where, yeah, 2 years ago, I reported on Alberto Salazar in a follow-up to the Mary Kane story. That's not going on Sidious. Like, I needed Sports Illustrated's lawyers to look some of that stuff over.
Yeah, that's, and definitely
so,
SI.
Yeah, so that was definitely SI. And then, so it's kind of like, I get that question a lot, sort of like, how do you know what to do what for which site? And I'm like, well, it's just kind of like, if I'm having more fun, then it goes, you know, for Sidious. And then if it's a little bit more serious, straightforward, then it goes to Sports Illustrated.
I mean, that's a pretty cool thing to be able to do. Say, oh, hey, we're just going to go ahead and, oh, this is fun. Yeah, let's go this route. Oh, shoot, lawyers involved, Mary Kane, Galen Rupp, or, you know, Bill Sales are, we need to put that on the SI thing. So this kind of, and it is pretty cool opportunity. So, you know, I know that Tim has moved on, that there could be an absolute chance that you could be the Olympic reporter for SI. I mean, that's when you said, walk out of college, you have an SI or an ESPN offer, you're going, ooh, that's pretty nice. But now the way it's gone is something incredible. So how many So you've sit down, you've mentioned Ascrip Stories. If you read through it, you even had Merber, you've had a few of the others on, Bumble was on. Would you just have Ryan Hill as well? Am I correct on that? Yep. And you've had many. I mean, I could go through it. I'm just going with a few, three that you just finished up with Oscar, of course, because you mentioned that's the first one. What was, so let's have fun with this. And maybe it's not a track athlete. Who knows who it is? Who's the favorite one you've ever interviewed? And at the same time, which one's the toughest one you've ever done? I bet you Mike Nelson might be the toughest one. No questions about that. I mean, he is a barn burner when it comes to things. But no, what's the best one, most favorite, and what's the toughest one you've ever done?
Oh, it's a good question. I kind of have been leaning really heavily on picking Nick Willis as the best, because this one was February 2020, last year, before the Milrose Games. I just kind of hit him up and I said, listen, I've always wanted to have you on the podcast, but it should be like an in-person conversation where I want to go through your career and the kind of the keys to your longevity. And I came into that interview with like a couple pages of notes, and I think I might've surprised him a little bit to, you know, really be like, whoa, like how'd you, like we're really getting into the details of some of these really awesome races and moments in his career. And so I love doing those deep dives on people's careers. Jenny Simpson, that one was a challenge because she said we only have like an hour before she had to go do something else. We got through that whole hour. And then afterwards she's like, we have to do this again. Cause I was like, really sort of like therapeutic in a way. Mm-hmm. But also just like lots of fun to go back. So, you know, Nick Willis and Jenny Simpson are definitely some of the best. Most recently, the Kyle Merber episode is the longest one I've ever done. That's 2.5 hours, almost 2.5 hours. And it was just sort of like, we're like, we sat down and we're like, all right, you need to get some stuff off your chest, right? And so he just kind of threw out all these different ideas that he has sort of for the sport. And I'm also just sort of, I feel like Kyle and I are of the same sort of generation and era within the sport where, yeah, I guess we're in our late 20s or maybe he's 30. We can take up sort of this mantle of like helping trying to advance the sport as we both kind of get a little bit older. So that one was fun. I'm trying to think of like who's most challenging. So I never get in like nervous for any of these interviews. I'll tell a funny story where it was like the first time I had the opportunity to interview Bolt, or not even like interview Usain Bolt. It was get to ask him a question. And this is the summer of 2013 out in Europe. I made it a mission of mine. Like, Chris, you're going to ask Usain Bolt a question this summer. And so Paris Diamond League pre-race press conference happens. And the guy asks, like, does anyone have any questions? My hand shoots up and I'm the first person picked. 19-year-old kid sitting in the front row. Pick that kid. I didn't have a question. And I just blurted out some sort of word, a couple words. And like, I have no idea what I said. And like, I guess like I could go back and try and find that FlowTrack video. But he got a question out of it and gave a response. And I was like, okay, Chris, mission accomplished. You did it. And then like did it a couple more times throughout the summer, I think in like London and that kind of stuff. And I've gotten the chance to sit down with him like one-on-one, a couple times now. And so definitely don't get nervous anymore, but that was one of the more interesting sort of little moments where you're like, oh, brain fart at the worst time.
You should go back and see if you can figure out what you actually said for that. Just for the, you know, I mean, like, oh my goodness, yeah. Look where I came from. I said two words. Actually, I didn't say a question. Only two words registered because it was Usain Bolt.
Yeah, I have no idea what it was to this day.
So you brought up something. You talked about Merber, and then you guys talked about how you kind of from the same pod. And one thing we've talked a lot about on this podcast, we do it on a weekly, good night, we do it on a weekly basis. There's no questions about it, is changing the sport itself. And I'm not going to go into the collegiate world because I think that's a whole nother world that we don't need to talk about. We don't need to do, we can talk about it if you want, but you talk about changing the sport itself. We have some changes coming with the two Pro Track series is going on. I know, I believe the American Track League is starting theirs up this weekend, possibly in Fayetteville. I'd have to double check. Yeah. And then I know the Pro Track series is focusing outdoors, which are both are incredible things for the sport. But how do we change the sport? You're a guy that's been around this since 18, 19 years old, writing for the Marquette Tribune and down with the Journal Sentinel, all that stuff. And now you're with SI about to be the big guy. What do you think we do to change the sport?
Yeah. I mean, it's so tough because, like, you know, I think when I was at Marquette, I thought, you know, slowly but surely, if we do all things right, like, we can make this into the NFL and, like, we can make this into an A-list sport. But I'm kind of at that point where, like, I just kind of recognize that it's never going to get to that point. And that's okay. Like, I think we just kind of take the people who do love track, obviously welcome anyone who wants to, you know, become a track fan, but really just kind of improve the product of and the presentation of it. Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me sometimes to know, come from, like, the flow track side of things and know that, you know, there is a business behind it. And that's why paywalls sort of make sense. Same thing with runner space and all that kind of stuff. But it hurts a little bit of the accessibility and the entry point for people to get in. Like, the Sound Running Meet out in Los Angeles is great. But do you think, like, it really attracted any new person to go out there and subscribe to Runner Space and be like, really, I want to check this thing out? If it, like, that's the type of meet that if I would have been home on that Friday night and the paywall would have stopped me from being able to watch it, like, then I wouldn't be here talking to you guys because I wouldn't have been able to see the meet. So, you know, it's a give and take. It's really hard because they have to pay the bills too, but it's sort of acknowledging and how we can make this free. Like, for example, right now I'm working really closely with the Trials of Miles Racing series guys. And so we're putting on this meet in Austin, Texas in a couple weeks. And the goal there is to get people qualified for the Olympic trials and the Olympics. But what we're really harping on right now, and is definitely, like, the most expensive thing, I think, is making this broadcast free for people. That's the big thing. The main reason why I came on to the project was because I'm like, let's toss this up on the Sidious Mag YouTube channel. We'll hire out a company. It's looking like it'll be like $11,000 or $14,000, but I want this thing to be free. Because if you put it behind a paywall, then again, it's just another meet that's behind one of these paywalls. But the fact that we're attracting these big names to come out and throw down these fast times, like, people should see that. And I go back to constantly thinking, like, what if that Friday night I would have hit a paywall? And then, like, and so I just don't want that. So yeah, I mean, like, there's a burden that comes with that for sure. Merber and I talked about on our podcast together, sort of making people care about some of the big events that already exist. The Penn relays, the Drake relays. And his first step is like, let's not have those two things on the same weekend. Because so hundreds of thousands of people pack that stadium at Franklin Field. Mm-hmm. So people do still recognize and love the Penn relays. People turn out for that kind of thing. And so it's really amplifying and bolstering sort of like the professional events, the college events there. These are events that already sort of exist. And then on the grassroots level, I think this is all sort of coming off of Kyle's brain, but I'll sort of like push it out here too, these mile events, the Sir Walter Miler, the Westchester Mile, Falmouth Mile, like, these are great events for, you know, the middle distances. And like, we've gotten that down. Like, I love seeing the photos of 2,000 people crowded around creating this Tour de France-esque atmosphere for runners. But, you know, so now it's like the idea is take it a step further, do it for a different event. And Kyle said if there ever was another Long Island Mile that he organized, why not have a 100-meter dash with some pros and that same tunnel going down the straightaway for 100 meters? Like, that'd be really cool to see. And not only that, but now you're introducing that sprinter 100 meter community to these fans, and they're so much more invested. So there's that. There's the storytelling component too. I think if I found a way to clone myself and a couple of these other, like, writers that are out there who are doing a great job of covering the sport, then that'd be great, because we could have more of these stories told. I wish I had a podcast producer. I handle all the recording, editing, and like marketing for my podcast. But if I had a podcast producer, like, I'd be keeping that person busy. I'd be doing, you know, 3 episodes a week and that kind of stuff. And that's just so many more stories to tell. Again, Kyle harped on the fact it's the athletes also have to do a much better job of doing it too. You know, really embracing the fact of like finding your reason why people should care about you and making and pushing it out to people, because we're already starting to see sort of some of these major companies and stuff are leaning away from sponsoring these athletes in favor of influencers. I know there's the fitness influencer community here in New York is huge. And some of these people are landing deals. But I think what professional runners and jumpers and throwers do is so much more impressive. There's no reason why, you know, Joe Kovacs, if you found out like what he benches and like all that kind of stuff, what he puts up in the gym, it's so, so impressive. And like, he should be a much bigger name. You know, I'm working closely with Joe on writing a book with him. Yep. And I acknowledge that there's this awesome story and I'm helping him sort of tell it in due time, but like, I'm already, you know, I have the idea. I was like, he and I need to show up to an Equinox gym here in New York City where I'm behind him trying to spot him on a bench. And like this, a type of video like that would go viral, or just the fact that people in an Equinox would have to react to this thrower in the corner, putting up the most weight ever, like that anyone has ever seen. He's one of the strongest human beings out there. And so, yeah, I mean, like, there's a storytelling component. There's just so much that could be improved, I would say. I don't think anything needs a radical sort of change. But there's just a lot of improvement, areas for improvement within the sport.
You know, I think you're onto something there. I think you're seeing a lot of track and field athletes on Instagram, TikTok, and they're kind of going that influencer route. I don't know if you've noticed that or seen that trend, but I think that's really smart for a lot of our track and field athletes to start building their brand in that way.
Yeah, I think you have to take it a step further beyond just posting the really cool running photo. And that's what a lot of people just tend to do. There's a witty caption that goes with it, but you're still just a runner posting, you know, running photos. I do that. And like, I'm kind of more conscious of like, Chris, I think you need to post more photos of you in non-running clothes, because it's getting to be a little bit weird. But then, you know, it's sort of finding that extra reason why. We know Stephanie Bruce does a tremendous job, because, you know, she's backing up her performance at a super high level. And at the same time, she's so relatable to tons and tons of mothers out there. She's really funny. Scott Fobel doing the burrito thing, the movie thing. It's just like the NAZ group does, I think, the best job of sort of peeling back beyond the athlete for people to see. So they don't just have this brand, and which is a really, you know, I hate using that word, but it really is. They have more of a brand than just the runner. And so I do like seeing that athletes are posting, but it has to be more than just the running photo every 2 days or something like that.
I thought what Joe Kovacs did a couple of weeks ago was great. I think, I can't remember what NFL player was talking about how strong they were. And, you know, he went out, what did he squat, like 700 for 10 or something crazy like that? I mean, just an absolutely insane weight room number. And he went and started calling people out. Like, I'll bet you this, you come on out, you put the weight on the bar, we'll see. And everybody was like, you have no idea how strong this guy is. And he's like, yeah, I'm that strong, you know, which I thought was, you know, a good way to, you know, you talk about a brand or just to develop, you know, people knew who he was all of a sudden that were NFL guys, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm curious though, you know, with high school track and field, you know, has obviously the biggest participation rate, and we lose so many of those people, you know, in terms of fans and people that are still interested. And yet we have this grassroots group that's so big. You made it through, you know, you went from being one of those high school runners to being somebody that's as passionate about track and field as anybody I've ever talked about. What would you say to somebody in order to give them some light onto what you find so exciting and passionate? I think, you know what I'm like, how would you say, hey, listen, here's why you need to continue to be invested in or a fan of this sport, being somebody that did it himself at such a high level?
Yeah. And that's interesting, because I'm starting to realize that the high school kids are taking it upon themselves to do it on their own. These high school kids are launching their own YouTube channels, and they've got, you know, 30,000 plus subscribers, and they're showing sort of, and they're putting out this really cool content that I'm guessing the kids who go to school with them think is really cool. And then all of a sudden you've got so many high school kids, across the country, starting to know who the top end of these kids are and following them and realizing that they're, you know, a sub four chase among like some of these high school kids gets hyped up. And all of a sudden they organize, there's an example where they organize their own meet in the middle of May to get a sub four done. I thought that was really, really was impressive. Mm-hmm. And so like, I think the high school kids are taking it upon themselves to make sort of track cool among them. But for the ones who are in college and are past sort of like their competitive days, I think it's a little bit different when I was in college, because I don't think I was on Instagram as much, but you know, I still know a ton of people who do go on to not run in college or run for fun, but they, for some reason, find that Molly Seidel is really funny on Instagram and they're following her. And so there's more of the individualized sort of like fandom, I would say, where people are now are maybe not as much fans of watching, sitting there and watching an entire pre-classic, but they are fans of the individual athletes and are keeping up with the races that they're running or the results. And so maybe in that case, there's something where the marathon project, they find out that their favorite athlete is competing in it. They'll find a way to tune in and that kind of stuff. It happened with like one of my friends here in New York City. And I like this sort of group as sort of like my guinea pigs, where they didn't run in high school. They didn't run in college. They just started running socially in New York City, joined the Brooklyn Track Club that I'm a part of, and then all of a sudden got competitive. But what happens is I will sometimes sit down with them after a run and I'll show them some cool YouTube videos. I'm like, hey, watch this race. Tends to be the 2008 Olympic Trials 800. And I'm like, you can watch this race six different times and watch a different person, and you're going to kind of see how the race unfolds in many different ways. And this is why, like, this is a really great race to watch. Then I'll show them Rudisha's like 800. And I'm like, this is the perfect race. And then all of a sudden they're hooked and they're like, well, now I want to watch, show me a different race or show me another race and that kind of stuff, where now I have to sort of get creative and in the weeds sort of with finding different races for them to watch. But it's hard because there isn't that me for all these different sort of people. But I don't know exactly if there's like an exact sort of formula to it. And it kind of bugs me because I'm a solutions guy. Like, I would love for there to be a perfect solution for it. But yeah, I think it is sort of a little bit individualized, and the high school kids are doing a good job of it right now.
One of the things I keep going back to is you said you watched that meet for free, and you know, that kind of set you on this long path. And now you're seeing it with the high school kids. I mean, I always come back to, it's really encouraging. I see the stuff that my athletes are putting out. You know, it's encouraging to see them trying to build their own brand, to showcase their talents. And knowing that you're trying to work to keep high level track and field or high level events broadcast out to the world, at least for cheap or for free. I think you're inspiring that next generation to continue down that path, and maybe, you know, you're talking about wanting more of you or being able to clone you. Maybe you're doing that without even thinking about it.
Yeah, I have given some thought to that. It was funny. I think I forget who it was. It was Ben Crawford, who has like a lot of really cool videos on his YouTube channel. He's a young kid out at Oregon. And he might've messaged me once where he was just like, you walked so I can run. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool to hear.
Awesome.
But then at the same time, what I ultimately, this is something that I've got, you know, in the back of my mind, especially this past year, with just a lot of the civil unrest sort of that was going on in the country. I look around in the media zone from time to time and I see like, oh, this is, you know, I'm the one of the only people of color here. And, you know, there isn't another person that looks like me here. I'm like super young. And I wonder sort of, it's like what our sport is, you know, the sprints and that kind of stuff is very predominantly Black, I would say. So where's the Black track and field reporter out here to help sort of tell some of these stories? I mean, I'm not complaining that I have to tell some of these stories, but I feel like there should be two or three other people here with me. And what I want to do at some point, and this is sort of like throwing ideas sort of on a wall, is I do want to start like a somewhat you know, media boot camp of sorts, where it takes the same exact model as the Sports Journalism Institute, where I'll find 13 students from across the country. And, you know, we'll do a boot camp, maybe at the University of Oregon or something like that, where for a week, it'll be hearing from media professionals. It'll be hearing from some of these different creative content, you know, people, whether they're working in video or podcasting and or writing, and getting sort of like that next generation to be further inspired by other people doing it really well in the sport. But then at the same time, what would be important is putting that into practice. And so if I can get 13 credentials to the NCAA championships, then that I can take these 13 students to go cover the event, throw them assignments, be like, all right, you're writing the Shopit story, you're writing the steeplechase story, and you guys are on a deadline. So you guys are going to have like 2 hours after your event. And maybe it ends up on a website we create for this thing. It ends up on Sidious Mag, whatever it is. They're getting that real firsthand experience. And then from there, and again, just ideas I'm throwing out there, this would be sort of like the perfect opportunity for, you know, sites like FlowTrack and Runner Space and Runner's World, Women's Running to come together. And, you know, you guys are now going to take these 13 students, one of each, and they're going to be your intern for the summer for 10 weeks. And at the end of the 10 weeks, maybe they get a stipend or a scholarship. But it would be sort of like establishing sort of that real hand experience. This is just, it's a big idea I want to someday do. I'm 28 years old. I'm going to still be covering the sport for a couple more years, but I do acknowledge I want more. I want more people sort of like me, but also just sort of even more motivated than me to go above and beyond for the sport. So it's just an idea that came across me. And not only that, it's just like, it's 13 students, some of them of color, of course. And I just want to do that sort of for, cause I want the 2024 Olympic trials to look a little bit different for me in the media zone.
You know, I think you bring up a really good point, because, you know, we as coaches talk about all the time, what can we do for the sport? But I truly think what you're talking about, you know, will it ever be the NFL? Probably not. But what you're talking about is track and field enthusiasts covering the sport in a way where it's relatable to the normal person, right? And bringing it to the people in an entertaining way. I think that medium right there could be huge for our sport in the longevity and also growing it.
But you're also giving them some guidelines. Like, it's beyond just, hey, you're an enthusiast, let's talk about the sport. You're giving them some guidelines, and you're funneling them in a direction that gives casual viewers or listeners or whatever the medium idea of where they're going, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I really want this to be a boot camp, because it's like, it's not going to be all fun and games. And, you know, I don't want people to show up to this thing and all of a sudden they're just fans trying to pull what I did, is get the credential to get up close to sort of like the athletes and fanboy, fangirl in front of them. Like, I want this to actually be, you're going to be professional in these sort of settings. And, you know, there is a level of objectivity that comes into it. Yeah, I mean, I'm friends with a bunch of these athletes as well. It's such a small sport. How could you not be? But there is sort of that professionalism that you can also bring to it. And so I do love seeing when high school, college kids start their own running blogs, because that's the number one piece of advice I would give people typically, is just write and put it into practice. You might be getting 3 or 20 people reading an article, but you're getting those small reps in. And the more small reps you do, the stronger you'll get. And then ultimately you could find a place where they take that shot on you and you get the big reps.
Absolutely love what you're going to do with the NCAA championships and doing that kind of thing. I think it's perfect. I think, I bet you if you went out and talked to Sam Seams, or, you know, called the USTF and said, hey, Sam, what is what I want to do? Do you want to help? Cause he's a guy that if you have an idea, he takes it and he'll try and find a way and he'll run with it. No questions about it. I bet you a guy like Sam or even Jeff Malinsky, you know, if you contacted him, both those guys would say, you know what, this is awesome. It's an internship. All you got to do is get them out there. Maybe we can help out paying. Maybe we can work some hotel deal out or something like that. I would almost guarantee you that this is something that you know, again, maybe not this year because we all have other circumstances and who knows what the championships are actually going to look like. And the rumors we've heard, we might even have regionals, outdoor regionals. So who knows what's going to happen. But like next year, could that be something in place that gives you 18 months to get this going? I could bet you, you know, you say you're 28, by the time you're 30, I bet you could have that in place. I bet you there's a lot of us that would be more than willing to help that out too. No questions about it. I love the idea of where you're going with this.
Yeah, it's just sort of that, you know, obviously being locked in my apartment, I've had a lot of time to think on things. And so, yeah, that was one of the big ones that I came about with.
One of the things I have a question, I mean, the way you talk, you know, you echo a lot of athletic terms or even your journey. It's similar to young coaches getting into the profession. What has athletics or your entire journey, how do you take your own athletic approach and utilize it to do what you're doing with Sidious Mag and Sports Illustrated?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I feel like I'm in a sort of position where I am still out here. I just finished up a workout maybe an hour or two before I jumped on this call. I'm still trying to get the best out of myself. Like I know my PRs are still ahead of me, I think. And so for me, I push myself. I know what it's like to go after a goal. For me, it's breaking 5 minutes for the mile. But if you take it sort of in the professional setting, it's breaking 4 minutes for the mile or breaking whatever, 4 minutes for 1500 on the women's side. Like there are people who are pushing themselves to do that kind of stuff. And so for me, I come into the sport, people look at me, one, I look really young. I'm 27, but I might look like I'm 20. So I'm, I guess, more of a, I bring some boyish charm sort of to the profession. And then at the same time, I bring that firsthand sort of experience to sort of the mix zone. I can talk to someone chasing a 4 minute mile and kind of relate it to what I'm doing right now, trying to break 5 minutes for the mile. There's that relatability that I sort of bring. And so it's not the same when you go to an NBA game or an NFL game. And, you know, if a guy gets criticized for doing something bad in a game by like a reporter or something like that, they might bark back and be like, well, you never played the game. And I feel like I can never really have that said to me because I'm still doing it. I'm still chasing goals and going for my best. So I know what that's like sort of. And so in a way, I take the lessons of my sort of firsthand experience in the sport and bring it to what I'm doing sort of when I'm asking sort of questions to people. And like, for example, I think it was during quarantine, I did an interview with Des Linden and we were drinking whiskey during it. So I was a little bit looser. I said to her, you know, like how have you been turning it on right now during quarantine? There's no official races. There's nothing really going on. But for some reason, like what is getting you going? Because I'm struggling with this. Like I just went out to try and time trial at 5K and I ended up like a minute and a half off like my personal best. So like, what did you do differently to kind of get that spark going for you? Yes, selfishly, I'm looking for an answer for myself, but I think it's something that other people are probably wondering. When I was running the Boston Marathon, I asked Shalane to do a mile by mile course breakdown for me. And I wrote it up for Sports Illustrated. But it was actually for me because I was training for that race. But I realized that in the grand scheme of things, there's other people who are wondering the sort of the same thing as me. So because I belong to that back of the pack runner population, but I can have those conversations with the people in the front, then I think that's like the connection that I sort of like try to make.
Chris, I've always enjoyed following you on Strava. And I forget, it was a few months ago, you tried to go out and break five at a meet in Jersey City,
mm-hmm.
Just right up the road, and you missed it. Would you run like about 5:10 or so?
Yeah, 5:09.
Yeah, and you could just tell, like, you know, in your writing about it, that you were seriously disappointed.
Yeah,
were really down about it. And it was like, I can identify with this guy, you know? And I think when other athletes and coaches read that and see that, it's like you just said about a reporter who'd never played the game of basketball, you know, well, this guy's out. He's walking the walk, you know, and he's doing it. And he's had some highs and maybe he's had some lows. But it's like you're more likely to really identify with someone who's going out and you feel like they're fighting the same battles you might be fighting.
Yeah, sometimes I try not to play it up too much because my training partners have caught on to the fact that when I am disappointed after a race and I'll throw up an Instagram photo or write something on Strava, they're like all the comment section and the positivity that sort of fills that sort of void from people maybe I've never met before. They're like, man, Chris, like people really come out of the woodwork for like, it reads like as if someone killed your dog. And it was like, and all of a sudden I have these people who have my back out of nowhere. But so like, I appreciate sort of that sense of community that is really built out, I guess, from my work. And then kind of like one big component to that has been sort of starting Sidious Mag, because people sort of remembered me from doing Workout Wednesdays and interviews on FlowTrack. And occasionally I'd pop up in front of the camera from time to time. But then in the period when I'm working for ESPN and Sports Illustrated, that's a time where I'm mainly just writing. And I always kind of remember that when you're reading an article, you can very quickly just scroll over the name. And so for that period of time, I really don't feel like people got to know sort of like my personality. And then starting the podcast and really getting active with it, sort of people will catch on to sort of like my sense of humor and just the following me on like Instagram. Like it just peeled back that extra curtain where, again, I guess I might be a little bit more relatable as a result.
Have the battles, the relatability though. If you can actually get people to relate to you, you're going to be rocking and rolling. And you're right. I think you have done. You said the sense of humor. I think you've exactly done that. You've taken the Bill Simmons, like you say, hey, this is what he's going to do, and this is kind of a little bit off, but it's a little bit weird. If you like it, it's going to flow. And there's tons of people that love it because you said it's a combination of everything. All you have to do is go read the. I'm going to guess you wrote them, but the bios of all the contributors. At times on the Sidious Mag, you're smiling. I'm like, yeah, you wrote those. Like, some like, he likes tracking beer. That was one of them. And I was like, that's pretty simple. But a lot of them are actually quite hilarious. And those are, it's relatable stuff, everything that you get through that. So you have done an incredible job with that. Where do you see, so you kind of mapped out a plan. I'm not expecting you to map out a plan for track and field itself, because I don't know if the IAAF is really going to be listening or the USOC or anybody along those lines. But where would you like to see the actual sport go? The sport of track and field go, the meets go itself?
Yeah, I mean, just continue to try and bridge that gap between that front end and the back end of the two packs. And it's a struggle because I feel like I've had the same conversations with people since like 2015, 2014, where, you know, it's, I think the US Olympic marathon trials this year were just like the greatest event that I've attended. I remember because one, they did the closest thing to doing that because, but at the same time, still keeping with the integrity and honor and like of being at the Olympic trials. But what it really did was it took the best athletes, the professionals, all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you had another 300 plus women who a lot of these women hold full-time jobs and are parents and that kind of stuff. And those are the people who are going to bring 10 to 20 people to Atlanta to watch them race. And I thought that that was just awesome. No part of the course was quiet whatsoever. Personally, I knew I had a job to do there in covering the race, but I found a pocket of time to go out there and cheer on two of my best friends who were running in the race, like who I, you know, I'm really close with in New York City. And I cheered up because like, I was like, this is amazing for them to have this shared experience with, they know they're not going to make the Olympic team, but they worked hard for this moment and we really got to sort of cherish it. So if I could replicate sort of that atmosphere and the energy that was in the air in Atlanta, maybe COVID had already been there, but like eliminate that part of it. If I could take that air in Atlanta and that atmosphere and apply it to just every single event, that'd be amazing. I know that's not, it's not being realistic. We still are a very niche sport and it's okay to be, but let's just try and do our best to tweak certain things here and there to make the presentation and the product better.
Yeah, that's the one thing I think we always forget about. We are a niche sport, but we have to embrace that. And as you said, we have to create our brand to push this along, create the brand, help the brand out, but help each other out and find that relatable thing, the Bill Simmons thing that everybody can relate to and come back to and be like, yes, that is exactly what we got going on. Chris, this has been awesome. I truly appreciate you jumping on, joining the panel tonight. I know you just got done with the workout. You probably need to grab some food, do something along those lines. You never know what's going on. So, but thanks for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, of course. Thanks for having me. This is a ton of fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for joining us on the Off Track Podcast. It was incredible to have Chris Chavez on here, a gentleman who from the young age, 18, 19 years old, was already going after some huge goals, especially I love the fact he can't remember what the question he asked one of the fastest men in the world, Usain Bolt, was. But one thing I learned real quick was chase your goals. That's something we've heard from every single guest we've had on, is go ahead and chase your goals. Don't settle. Why are you doing that kind of stuff? I think Chris does an incredible job with the Sidious Mag and has done something, as he said, Bill Simmons-esque with the sport, and helped to bring some comedy, some life to it, and really interject something, a different side to the athletes that we don't see too much. As always, thank you for joining us tonight, and we really appreciate it. Please go ahead, share us, leave us a comment, retweet us, like us on Instagram, let our know friends know what you think. That word of mouth without question is the best way to get the word out about what we have going on. If you have ideas, please let us know. But if not, we look forward to talking to you again next Sunday night. Have a great night and great week, everybody.
You start your nail in the stump, and then everybody has one. There's like however many people around, six people around the stump. You start your nail on the stump, and then you get one swing. And then you have, if you don't knock it all the way in, you have to give the hammer to the next person, and they get one swing at their nail. And it just goes around till somebody gets the nail in. And like, if you kind of wing it, those nails just come off like a bullet. Like they come off like a rocket. And you're like, ping, they're up against the wall. And I'm like,
oh my God.
How could we even be doing this? You know, you can hardly see the nail. You're swinging a 3-pound sledgehammer. You know, it was so much fun though.
I got pretty good at it. My neighbor, the apartment I lived at, brought one of those, you know, big tree stumps into his apartment. And so we had plenty of practice.
There it is.
That's hammer slogging, Grant. Look at that. I think I heard what it's called.
Yep, hammer slogging.
Hammer slogging.